Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Gemma Atwal. She is director and producer of the film Marathon Boy, which screens at the Santa Fe Film Festival today at 2 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Hi, thanks for having me here.
What an extraordinary documentary. It's a documentary that if you were to have made it up, it wouldn't even be real. Let's talk about it. It's the story of a man, Biranshi Das, who took in orphans in the state of Orissa in India, and he took in a little boy named Budhya Singh. Give us some background on each of these two people and how this story began.
Right. Well, Budhya Singh is from the slums in Orissa, a place called Bhuvaneshwar, and he was this abandoned four-year-old boy whom Biranshi Das plucked from the slums and decided to mold into a champion marathon runner. Biranshi Das became this larger-than-life, dynamic foster father to Budhya as well. So, you know, the film follows their roller coaster ride over 5 years, and it actually becomes much more than just the story of Budhya and Biranshi. It's this shocking saga of greed, corruption, opportunism, and political conspiracy that all revolves around this unlikely little subject, Budhya.
Now, Budhya, it's such a funny moment in the film where they're talking about how his talent for running was discovered. He was this little abused kid with a foul mouth from the slums whose mother had sold him to a peddler for 800 rupees or something like that. And he starts speaking in foul language, and because Biranshi Das doesn't want to punish the kids by hitting them, he says, okay, I want you to run around the courtyard. He goes away, he goes to work. When he comes back, the child is still running. And that's how he finds out that he's a natural runner.
Yeah, I love that story. And I have to say, each time that Biranshi Das told it me, he embellished it ever so slightly each time. And it's suddenly become the making of myth, actually. It's this mythic tale of how he discovered the boy's talent, and it became a real catalyst event for him. He also told me that he was watching an ESPN sports show, and he noticed that Budhya's running style resembled that of Kenyan athletes. And that also sowed the seed for him, and he decided from that moment to train him into becoming India's greatest runner.
Now, how did you become aware of this story and start filming it?
It was back in 2005. I came across a BBC News web story on a very small boy from the Indian slums who was running these huge distances on a daily basis. And it was both astounding and unsettling. Thoughts of a boy running his way to a better future or out the slums sprang to mind. And I remember really clearly there was this photograph of Budhya's coach, Biranshi Das, with him. And their relationship instantly fascinated me because Biranshi seemed to occupy that potent dual role in the boy's life of being both a foster father and a coach. And so I wanted to understand more about the psychology of their relationship, why Budhya runs these distances for him, and what would be the consequences of stopping. And I was also thinking about the spiritual significance of their relationship, for which we don't really have an equivalent in the West. It's that bond between a guru and a disciple, which is seen as more sacred than between a mother and a son. So that was really the spur for me to go out and find them, to locate Budhya and Biranshi. Personal circumstances drew me in a little bit as well. My mother is from the Indian slums as well. She lived in abject poverty, but she gave me up because I was a girl, as often happens in Indian society. There's this huge importance placed on having a son. And a twist of fate led me to be adopted by a couple in England, and I led this entirely different life full of opportunity. So I wanted to go out there and understand more about Budhya's birth mother, actually, Sukanti, who gave up Budhya, and really understand the choices that she made.
And she has a role in this film, too, and I encourage everybody to see it because it's far more complex than we can go into in a brief interview. But there is a hardness about her which was very clear even just from her face. And I wondered, I mean, you see this little child who has been clearly beaten and neglected. Then he gets taken in, and you see the profound love and support and everything that Baranchi Das gives him. And yet I wondered, with all of this incredible discipline that goes into being a runner, and Baranchi Das is a judo coach as well. He's got this whole dojo with lots of orphans in it, not just this one child. I wondered if that intense athletic discipline in such a small child delayed or suppressed the kind of emotional healing that an abused child needs. In other words, did he ever have the chance to be a child, to cry, to talk, to be himself?
Right, and that's one of the things that worried me from the outset, actually, and for a long time into filming, is that we never actually hear Budia's voice. I mean, his true voice, speaking for himself. And I think it's only at the end of the film, when he's 9 years old, that you truly hear his voice, which is one of a very conflicted boy. But, you know, why he ran those distances always used to concern me, actually, and puzzle me. And I think it's certainly incredible that Budi was able to run huge distances, but the kind of pressure on him and the expectations placed on him may well prove in the long run to have a damaging effect. And I think Budi understood the fact that he was being showered with a lot of attention and that he was given a lot of approval when he accomplished these feats, which doubtless served as some kind of reinforcement. You know, it's a very natural human tendency to try to maximize on approval, to try and push yourself more to engage in a certain kind of behavior. So one theory is that perhaps Budi runs because he keeps getting that reinforcement. And then, as you rightly point out, you know, this is a boy who was sold twice by the age of three, and what is the emotional impact of that? And then one day he meets someone who's willing to take him in, provide his basic needs, and give him this new identity, I am a runner. So perhaps he values what he has now, which is identity, security, food each day, praise, against what he had before, which is nothing. So is running Budia's way of showing gratitude to Baranchi? I want to please him because he's good to me. But then Budia's eggs, as we know, are all in one basket. He has to run. And how much pressure is on this boy's shoulders? And, you know, I was quite disturbed from an early stage, and I really wanted to ask experts, pediatric sports experts in the UK and the US, can a child be forced into running? And they all said no, which surprised me, actually. They said at his age, it has to be 99.777% genetic ability because, you know, his hormones haven't kicked in until he reaches puberty. So you can't actually train a boy that young. He's not an aerobic, anaerobic machine. So it has to be prodigious talent. But watching Budia and Baranchi, you know, there were times when their relationship verged on something akin to Stockholm syndrome. I think that's the only way I can describe it, between a captor and a captive. And the way a captor will provide your very basic needs or very small gestures of kindness, and these are interpreted by the captive as something bigger than they actually are. And watching Budia, I think a child can be forced into doing pretty much anything, depending on the type of relationship that he or she has with the nearest identified adult. Because a very young child does not have a sense of self or a sense of I. You know, his or her very existence is directly linked to the caregiver. So if the caregiver has a particularly strict expectation or is in some way manipulating that child's behavior, then the child can actually, to a great extent, I believe, be forced into doing pretty much anything.
Well, I think the talent for running is very clear. And I mean, there are people who have talents for example, ballet dancing. And at Budia's age, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, they start into what becomes a lifelong athletic and artistic path. And if not at 4 years old, they better start pretty early because that's what you have to do. I really didn't have as many questions about the athletic part of it, like can he be forced into doing that particular activity, as I did into this other question of, did he get his just little boy emotional needs met. And then there was this whole question of the ORISA equivalent of Child Protective Services came in, and they mounted a major campaign against Biranshi Das. And again, I mean, the film has so many layers of emotional and moral complexity, because they have this big campaign against this man when there's all these other starving, abused, and neglected children who they're really not doing the same amount of work to protect.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting because I think Boudia's emotional needs were fulfilled by Biranshi's wife. And, you know, it's just because of time in the documentary and how many different characters you can go into. She was an incredible woman. She features in the film, but not to the extent that I would have liked. And she was actually opposed to Boudia's running. She very much wanted him to be educated, you know, to the best level. She wanted him to do some sport, but not to the same extent. And she really did provide that kind of mother figure that Boudia never had, really. So, you know, the role of both mothers in Boudia's life really fascinated me from an early stage. So he did have that, but unfortunately you don't really see it. He didn't have it so much with Biranshi, because he's not necessarily a man that will show emotions in that way, although I genuinely believe he loved Boudia. But, you know, the Child Welfare Committee and the government, you know, I'd have the same questions in my mind all the time, and that's who has the right to define abuse at this level of society. Does the government have more right over someone who's a product of their failed policies? And what is the vested interest of a state government in one child when there are hundreds and thousands of voiceless children on their watch living in great social misery? And, you know, the Child Welfare Committee, their duty was to ensure that the basic needs of every child in this particular area are met. They just went after Boudia and Biranshi because the spotlight was on Boudia. You know, international press were looking in, national press were looking in, what are you doing in this boy's case? The issue, however, became that Biranshi refused to accept that any group or individual would be against him. He would take them on, and he felt empowered to do so because the entire media were backing him up. And as a result, he could show the Child Welfare Committee in a very bad light. And they knew that the publicity in favor of Biranshi and Boudia was going against them. And this effectively rubbed them up the wrong way. It became personal. Their job was to protect Boudia, but it was no longer about Boudia. They wanted to punish Biranshi Das. And probably it was a jurisdiction of other courts to decide whether this man has, you know, minted money or embezzled funds. But the Child Welfare Committee felt empowered in their turn by the blessings and support from the highest in government. And so what it became was this outright war between the state of ORISA on the one hand and Biranshi Das on the other, because every government worries about its image with the people. They wanted to influence the people in the same way that Biranshi Das could, and they tried to do so through accusations and arrests and these grandiose displays of force, any means possible to weaken and crush Biranshi. You know, it's a travesty of justice in my view that this man was sent to jail on a false charge concocted by a committee for child welfare that bribed a small boy. I mean, it's so convoluted, but they'd had enough. You know, very often Biranshi, while I was there, would be having these constant confrontations with ministers and politicians via the media. He'd throw out a challenge or cast aspersions on someone's character. He was not at all diplomatic. He invited trouble on himself, and I think he enjoyed being this controversial figure, but he started to create enemies. But, you know, just imagine the power this one man, this poor man, exuded, and the strong faith in himself that it required an entire state government to unite to defeat him.
And we don't want to give away the movie, but as I said earlier, if you were to have written this as a fictional narrative film, nobody would believe it. But the fact that it's a documentary and it's made by HBO, I mean, here is a real story, and it just gives one so much to think about and contemplate and to discuss. It's just an extraordinary documentary, and I want to let people know that it is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival at the Center for Contemporary Arts today at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it is also premiering on HBO on the 3rd of November. I guess you've done a lot of film festivals and won a lot of awards, and when all the festivals are done, this is one of the last ones, it'll be on TV.
Yeah, which is just fantastic. HBO are our majority funders, so having them on board was a complete dream. It's my first feature documentary, so to have their support, given the fact that I haven't got a track record, is wonderful. And, you know, November the 3rd is going to be seen by the widest possible audience. So I'm just ecstatic, actually.
Do you have any sense of how, I mean, there's already been so much publicity that's affected this child's life. Do you have any hopes or fears about how this worldwide publicity will come down on the life of this child who's still only, what, 9 or 10 years old?
Right. You know, the great thing is that he's pretty sheltered from all of it. I mean, he doesn't know about this enormous festival run that we've been on, the amount of people who've seen him. He doesn't know it's going to be on HBO documentary films. So, you know, from that perspective, it's great. And, you know, all of us were extremely touched by Budia's story, the entire crew. And we maintain regular contact with him, send him packages whenever we can. And, you know, I go out to see him quite frequently, but I don't talk about the film with him at all. I don't talk about, you know, the publicity it's generated at all. We just go to see how he is. And, you know, it's difficult to know how Budia's processed the events in his life and the long-term impact. And one of my main concerns is that there doesn't seem to be anyone to take care of his emotional well-being going forward. But, you know, on a positive note, he goes to a terrific school now. He's mixing with the highest echelons of Orissa society, and we hope that education will be his way out. And we've launched the Marathon Boy Trust Fund through our website, and we hope that people who see the film will be inspired to contribute to Budia's welfare. So, you know, his life is no longer this mini Truman Show. There's no Indian media allowed to interview him. No cameras are allowed to be in with him. So it should stay that way for a very long time to come, I think.
The website is marathonboymovie.com. Gemma Atwal is the director and producer of this fine film, once again at 2 o'clock today at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. The Santa Fe Film Festival is on the web at santafefilmfestival.com. Gemma, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a huge honor, and thank you to everyone at the Santa Fe Film Festival for supporting Marathon Boy.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Hughes Winborn. He is a film editor. Some of his films include The Help, The Great Debaters, Crash, Sling Blade, many more, and he is here as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. He will be doing a special presentation tomorrow, Saturday, the 22nd of October, with Kirk Ellis. And they will be speaking at 3 o'clock at Charlotte Jackson Fine Art. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Now, I wish we had all day long to talk about your work, because the work of a film editor is perhaps not as out in the spotlight as, certainly not as actors or even directors, but what you do makes or breaks a film. When you start working on a film, where do you come in? In other words, do you get the screenplay and start editing it in your head or in your vision? What is the process
like? Well, it depends. If I'm close to the director, if I've worked with the director before, I'm usually in very early. And even for the rewrite stage of the script. I mean, for instance, on The Help, I was hired a couple of months before they started shooting, and they were writing all the way up, or they were writing while they were shooting. And Taylor, the director, asked me to read, and I read, and I gave him notes and suggested things, and suggested whole swaths of the film to come out that turned out to be the best parts of the film. He didn't take them out wisely.
Very interesting. So when you work on set, the director is doing the director thing, the actors are acting, the director of cinematography is shooting, what are you doing?
Well, usually I'm not on set. I do come to set if they need me. Usually I'm close to set. I'm not always even on location. It's a trend, an unfortunate trend of the last 10 or 15 years that if the film's not shooting in Los Angeles, they often don't take the editor just for financial reasons, because it's a lot of money to put up the crew and hotels, feed them, et cetera, et cetera. But on The Help, you know, I was on location for the first time in Mississippi, and I was on the location for the first time in 14 years, and it was in Mississippi. And I had an editing room about usually no more than a mile away, and they would call me if they needed me. And if they knew something was coming up that needed me to help them with coverage or shots that it might need to put the scene together, they would call me and I would come to the set. But I'm not on the set a lot. Usually I'm cutting. If they shoot on Monday, I'm cutting what they shot on Monday on Wednesday, so I can show it to the director. And if we need to make changes, if we need to pick up things along the way, or if he needs to sort of change his approach, he'll be able to see what he's doing, and he can judge that, and we can talk about it.
So it's not like at the end of a shoot, they give you 10 gazillion hours of footage, and you have to start editing.
No, I usually have a cut together a week after shooting.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And on The Help, it was 3 hours. The first cut on The Help was 3 hours and 5 minutes, which is very long.
Yeah, and then you
then
had,
I had
what
to
happens?
Try to cut it down.
And again, is the director looking over your shoulder, or what's that process like?
Well, you know, that's different on every show as well. On this show, Tate was not looking over my shoulder all the time, which I appreciated. He came in, he gave me notes, he left, I did my work, he came back. And together, little by little, over, you know, after they finished shooting, I was still cutting for 6 months. So over a six-month period with previews and such, we got it down to 220, which is remarkable. I never thought it would be a two-hour and 20-minute movie.
You thought it would be shorter?
I thought at most it would be two.
Very interesting.
But, you know, interestingly enough, this is a DreamWorks film, and DreamWorks was very... very smart, and it's a great experience working there. They're great people, and in LA with the DGA, every director gets 10 weeks to do his cut, and at 7 weeks we were 247, and the studio said, go have a preview, we won't come, you go have it, you know, bring in an audience. We went to Kansas City. And this was really for Tate to go and go, look, your film is way too long. You got to cut it. This is your, you know, this is the cold water in the face. We went to Kansas City. We previewed, and we kicked butt. I mean, it was great. 240, and this was like, not 247, 242, something like that.
And so they sat there riveted and...
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it myself. I'd been so nervous. And then after that, it was, you know, it was just trying to get it down. We still got, another 20 minutes out of the movie. And we took some great stuff out of the film.
Yeah.
Which is always the hardest part. When you know you've got good stuff, you're taking good scenes out. What's really tragic is when you're... You know, you're cutting somebody's performance who is phenomenal.
Do you put that on the DVD later?
Yeah, you know, I mean, an interesting story for me was when I did 7 Pounds, Will Smith film with Gabriele Machino, there was one woman who had a part, because I don't know the story, probably everybody probably doesn't know, but there was one, he goes around meeting different people and trying to figure out a way he can help them in their lives, and there was one woman whose story was incredible, and she was a phenomenal actress, but there was one too many stories, and her part had to come out, and it was, you know, it was incredibly sad. It happens on every movie.
Yeah. Now, how has editing style changed in the time that you've been doing this? Because you've been doing it for quite a while. I mean, when you watch movies from the 1950s, there's such a different pacing and different styles and ways of editing.
Well, it's gotten a lot faster. I think first it was music videos, MTV, and there were a lot of great there were a lot of great films that sort of grew out of that style. Movies like Snatch, which everybody tried to emulate for a while. You know, I think people have gotten used to a very quick pace, and they're not as patient with films that take their time. I particularly like films that take their time. I particularly like to cut. I don't particularly like to cut just to cut. I like to cut, especially dialogue scenes. I don't like to move around a lot if I don't have to. And a lot of times, a lot of cutting will indicate a problem with performance or such something. You know, I always feel like cutting away from somebody who's given a great performance just to cut away is, it hurts. It hurts the movie, hurts the film dramatically, it hurts the intensity of the performance.
So when somebody wants an editor, they might come to you if they want a cutting style of the kind that you just described.
Yeah, no, they do. It's true. Yeah, I mean, like everything else in Hollywood, people get typecast, and I've cut a lot of different styles, but the films that I'm known for are typically dramatic, excuse me, and they're typically not, you know, quick cut films.
What are the, I mean, when you think about the history of films, what are the maybe great milestones in innovation in terms of editing?
Well, I don't think they're mine. Well, I can tell you that the one that's probably D.D. Allen had the most impact on editing as far as I'm concerned. Bonnie and Clyde was the big change.
Really?
And that's where a lot of the, you know, the rapid cuts came about. I mean, certainly Jean-Luc Godard, Breathless, the jump cuts.
Right, right.
You know, but I have to, you know, to be honest, I know these films, I studied these films when I was growing up, but they didn't really, if I took them in, I took them in the same way everybody else did.
Right.
You know, they just sort of, I didn't think about it. I don't think about it when I'm cutting. I don't think about the style. So, cutting is like music. You know, it's kind of like you watch the people perform, you watch the story evolve, and you just sort of come up with the flow yourself, you know, and I think it's unique to every person. It's like rhythm is to every person. It's different. And every editor, I think, has their own kind of rhythm, and they bring it to, if they have the chops, they bring it to the table when they're doing a film.
If you watch a film and you don't know who edited it, can you sometimes tell?
No. Not usually. No. If I notice the editing, it's usually because I notice a problem in the movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. Your job is basically to draw people into the spell and the magic of it without drawing attention to yourself.
That's right. Yeah. Unless the point is to call attention to it, you know, and that's the trick.
Yeah.
And that's what the rhythm is about. But by the same token, the rhythm can put you to sleep. You know, so you have to be very, it's very subtle. It's a very subtle art form, cutting a film. It's really interesting. I mean, the longer I do it, the more I realize, and it's cliche, but it's true, the more I realize how little I know about it.
Well, you will be speaking, we're talking to Academy Award-winning film editor Hughes Winborn, and you will be speaking to Kirk Ellis tomorrow at 3 o'clock at Charlotte Jackson Fine Art. Kirk Ellis being the many prize-winning author of the HBO series John Adams and much more. Are you going to be talking about editing?
We're going to talk about editing. I think we're going to talk about probably just a more expansive program like you and I are talking right now.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you are if you want to check that out, it's all part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Hughes Winborn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. And I'd like to welcome Rob DeWalt. He is with the Pasatiempo, Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's with us every Friday speaking of the arts. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Marianne Redding is curator of photography at the New Mexico History Museum. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, there is an amazing exhibition that's opening on Sunday, opening to the public on Sunday. There's a members opening tomorrow. What's it all about?
There are two exhibitions, actually. The one that I curated is Contemplative Landscape, and it's looking at how communities of faith ritualize a landscape through their spiritual practice, whether it's their art, the architecture, the people that inhabit that landscape.
And it's all black and white photography.
It's all black and white photography, yes it is.
And so I guess it feels like one exhibition, but it really is two, but they're in the same room. There's another exhibition of calligraphy.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that one.
That is St. John's Bible. The two shows together are Illuminating the Word, St. John's Bible, and the Contemplative Landscape. St. John's Bible was commissioned by the Benedictine Abbey in Colville, Minnesota, St. John's. Hence the name, St. John's Bible. But we have 22 huge vellum sheets that are done, hand-done in calligraphy, and they're beautiful in the old tradition of the monastic contemplation of the written word. Beautiful, illuminated pages that are hand-drawn, gold leaf. They're just gorgeous.
I have to say, I went up there yesterday just to check it out before talking to you today, and one cannot believe that any calligrapher using this Chinese ink and an actual quill, a feather quill, can do this. It reminded me of the Buddhist monks who do those sand mandalas and don't make any mistakes. It is absolutely insane and gorgeous.
But when actually in the pages, when they do make a mistake, that's called marginalia, and they will draw a little side drawing of a bird or an insect, and they'll correct it on the page.
It's like a little asterisk almost, saying, okay, this,
yes,
is,
this is a mistake, and we acknowledge it, and we'll make art out of it, which is really wonderful. And in the middle of the gallery, we've created a meditation space. I think you were in there yesterday, but you'll see the two shows, and they're integrated in the gallery. In the center, there's a stone fountain and four benches and a waterfall. So that
and
you
those
have
dark river rocks.
And the dark river rocks and the phases of the moon around the outside. So you have a place to sit and contemplate, which is really great.
It's a wonderful exhibition. Now, the public opening is Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4 o'clock. And Tony O'Brien and Christopher Merrill will be doing a book talk and a book signing for Tony O'Brien's new book, Light in the Desert, Photographs from the Monastery.
And we talked to him just the other day on this program. And Christopher Merrill, wonderful writer, poet. And there's also a members exhibition, and I wasn't going to announce it, but then people, if they want to be members, can show up, become members, and go to the members exhibition.
Absolutely.
I mean, opening.
Yes. If you look in Paso Tiempo, there's a phone number and an extension to call for more information about the members opening tomorrow night, which starts at 5 o'clock.
Mary Ann Redding, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rob DeWalt, we're getting a little bit of a late start today because we wanted to fit in Hughes Winborn, but that was worth it.
That was totally worth
it.
Yeah, I don't want to talk faster just to fit stuff in. Besides, I'm half asleep. So.
Okay, well, let's make it succinct. Santa Fe Film Festival. I went to the opening last night.
You did.
It was so wonderful. I just couldn't believe it. And we talked about Marathon Boy this morning. And
great movie.
Great movie. The movie Capsulas is at 4 o'clock at the CCA. We talked about that the other day. It's the film by a film by Guatemala's only woman filmmaker. And it's very low budget. It's very good. So much more. So just basically go hang out at the Santa Fe Film Festival, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. And then there's Santa Fe Independent Film Festival.
Yes.
Santa Fe Film Festival and Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. There's great coverage in the Paso Tiempo today. I covered the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival, and Mr. Robert Knott covered the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Oh, so what are some of the highlights of the Independent?
Some of the highlights of the Independent, if I can find the page that I just dog-eared 5 seconds ago and then lost. Let me find it.
Okay. While you find it, let me also tell you, somebody just came up to me whose film, The Encore of Tony Duran, is the closing movie at the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival, and closing night at Warehouse 21, Sunday at 7 o'clock is the movie, and it's closing night with Elliot Gould.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Elliot Gould.
The Elliot Gould will be here. Is that right?
In
real life.
Is that what it says?
It says this on the piece of paper that I'm looking at.
I'd love to meet Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
I'd love to. There's a lot of great films in Santa Fe Independent Film Festival this year. The highlights include White Knight, which is part of I believe it's part of the comedy program, and it's being shown with a great short called Hold the Mayo. And Hold the Mayo is a...
I saw that. That's gross.
It's awesome. Blood and mayonnaise. That's all I'm going to say about it. That's all I'm going to say. There's some capsule reviews of select films from both festivals in Paso Tiempo today. Some of the ones that I'm really looking forward to though, include, of course, Hold the Mayo, and the partner with which it is being screened, White Knight, which stars Tom Sizemore and Hector Jimenez. You might remember Hector from Nacho Libre.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the guy's just hilarious. And who else is in this? Oh, Stacy Keach. And it's great. It's about this grand dragon of the Texas Ku Klux Klan who gets sent to prison, to a sort of a labor camp, a labor farm. And he's basically put in a cell with this fellow, you know, and he's, you know, this Mexican fellow, and that doesn't really make him very happy. But the warden is sort of determined to change this guy's mind. And in the meantime, this Klansman falls in love with a Mexican cleaning lady who works at the prison farm. And that is screening at noon on Saturday, October 22nd, also at Warehouse 21. There's a great, really heart-wrenching film. I think it's one of the most like emotionally dense films at the festival this year, called The Welcome. And it's a documentary about all these veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam that got together in 2008 at a retreat near Ashland, Oregon. And they sort of learned how to sort of talk about what happened to them there and talk about their post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a really emotionally powerful film, and it's also a great tribute to our men and women in uniform. And that is playing at noon on Friday, today, at October at Warehouse 21. Excuse me.
Excellent.
So there's more capsule reviews. I haven't seen a lot of the films for the Santa Fe Film Festival because I've been working on the Independent Film Festival.
Right.
But some of the highlights that Robert Knott talks about include Marathon Boy.
Yes.
Wild Horses and Renegades.
Yes.
Did you see?
Yes.
Did you watch that?
It's very good.
And A Useful Life.
I haven't seen that.
Slow and Quiet, black and white drama.
Right. That's about a guy who's his movie theater closes, and so he has to actually learn to live in the real world instead of in the movie world.
Yeah. And that's
so you can go live in the movie world and pretend to be living the real world.
Yeah.
With him.
Yeah.
While he lives the real world.
And that one is, I believe that's screening today at 12:30 p.m. at The Screen.
Yep.
Right over there in the College of the University, Santa Fe University of Art and Design.
And I'm going to the Shorts program at 11:45. Linda Carfagno came up to me last night and said that she has a short film in there, and she's a lovely photographer around town. So I thought, oh, go see her film, local gal. And, but yeah, there's some good shorts too.
Very good short.
Santa Fe Film Festival. And so the other reason to go to Santa Fe Film Festival, besides that it's really good and you'll have a wonderful time, and it's so well curated. I mean, you know, Brent Cleaver and Diane Schneier-Perrin did an amazing job. Is that if you go support it, then it'll be here next year.
Right. That's the best way to do it.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know how things work at the Santa Fe Film Festival, but, you know, the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival tends to just operate, and they depend on ticket sales for their sort of core budget. You know, show up, you know, go next year because there's not going to be no films, right?
Exactly.
Right. And hey, this one probably grabbed your attention. The Sweet Salsa event.
Yes, I'm going.
You are going?
Of course.
Now, when is that? That's
tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center.
Yes.
It's a fundraiser for the CCA, and it features a salsa dancing, a salsa dance contest, chocolate, martinis, and mojitos.
And food by La Boca.
Yeah. You can't go wrong with any of those things. Any one of them individually is enough. All of them put together are an embarrassment of deliciousness.
Yeah. You can find tickets at the CCA website, ccasantafe.org. There's a link to the Sweet Salsa event on there. You can also call 982-1338 for more information. This is going to be a great event. They have Sabor, Cuban ensemble.
Also known as Sabor.
And they're going to have a DJ, and they're going to have an MC.
I'm an MC.
I talked to Sandra Napua, who is the CCA administrative manager, a couple of days ago, and she said that tons of people have already signed up for the contest.
Oh, good.
And a lot of couples from Albuquerque, so.
Yeah.
If, you know.
There was this couple that used to come down from Colorado. They used to just go to salsa dance contests and try to win. It was sort of like, you guys, that's just scamming.
How nice. I mean, that must be nice to be able to just do that, though.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, you know, let the local people have their contest.
Yeah, I know. It's like an architect traveling all over the world and doing sandcastle competitions. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's not fair.
And we do have some local people who can hold their own, so that's good too.
Yeah. Let's see what the tons of other stuff going on. Moby Dick, one of my favorite tribute bands. Excuse me. Led by Michael Baker and Andrew Prim, they are a Moby Dick is a Led Zeppelin tribute band.
Nice.
And they don't pull the wigs out that much, but they got them out, and they're performing at the Underground with Chongo at 9 p.m. tonight. And the Underground is, of course, inside Evangelos, downstairs, Interesting band. Low cover charge. It's pretty much a 21 and over show, obviously.
Excellent.
Because it's at a bar. But it's going to be awesome. And what else? Ooh, Deer Tick. Deer Tick, sort of a folk rock band, is going to be playing at Santa Fe Soul Stage and Grill on Thursday the 27th at 7:30 p.m. I believe doors open at 6 and tickets are available at the Lenzig box office, 988-1234. And, of course, we have lots of openings. Well, not a lot.
Before we say the openings, yeah. Can I let you know, that let people know that on Monday at 6 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts, David Barsamyan, host of Alternative Radio, is going to be at the CCA talking at 6 o'clock. And he was recently deported from India because his journalism was apparently a threat to the nation of India. He was reporting on what was going on in Kashmir. So he will be here on Monday.
I heard
very,
your
very important.
With him.
And Tuesday, Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now! Is going to be here at the Armory for the Arts talking about his new book, and that's a KSFR event.
And where's that?
It's at the Armory for the Arts Tuesday the 25th at, Mary Lynn, help me out, I think it's 7 o'clock. It's either 7 or 7:30. I'll find that out.
this is the last weekend for two things. The Arcos Dance Company. It's the dancers ages 14 to 25. This is the last weekend to see performances of The Raven, Liquid Days in Four Parts, and Dream a Little Dream of Me.
Yes.
And that's 7 p.m. There's a performance at 7:30 p.m. tonight at the Moving People Dance Performance Space over there on Pacheco Street.
Excellent.
If you call 473-7434, you can find tickets. And it's also the last weekend for Flamencas.
Yes, and that is a very good show, the one at the
mm-hmm.
Lodge.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's at the Lodge. There's a performance tonight at 8:30 p.m. There's tickets available at the Lenzik.
And the name of the main performer is?
I don't. Antonio Granjero?
Granjero, that's right. And he is amazing. They're all good, but he's out of this world.
And the Entre Flamenco Company as well.
Yep. By the way, Juan Gonzalez on Tuesday, co-host of Democracy Now!, Tuesday at the Armory for the Arts here in Santa Fe, 7:30 p.m. And I'll be introducing him. And he'll be doing a book signing, and his new book is really, really, really good.
In tandem with the film festivals, on Sunday the 23rd, we have an event called Jazz from the Silver Screen. Arlen Asher and Dave Anderson on woodwinds, and Robert Fox on piano, Richard Snyder on bass, and Cal Haynes on the drums at 4 p.m. Sunday at the Santa Fe Center for Spiritual Living over there on Camino de los Marques. And you can get tickets by calling 988-1088. Jazz from the Silver Screen. I'm trying to think of really, really topical films with lots of jazz in them.
Yeah, I'll try to think too. Yeah. And while we think, let me let you know that there's a book launch for the 30th annual Dixon Studio Tour commemorative book, Creating Art and Community, with readings by Stan Crawford, Harvey Frauenglass, Esteban Arellano, Michael Johnson, and Michael Wildgoose. That's at Collected Works Bookstore, October 22nd. That's tomorrow at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Neato. Hey, neato. Day of the Dead is right around the corner.
Yeah.
And this is a great family event. I'm going to try and get the God Kids to this on Sunday if I have time. This is a Sugar Skull Decorating Workshop over at Traveler's Market in DeVargas Center. And there is a prize for the skulls. And if you call 989-7667, you can find out more info. Again, that's 2 p.m. on Sunday. And then the following week, there's a great Day of the Dead event at El Museo de Cultural, which you will hear more about from me next week.
Excellent. Now, I got an email from a drummer named Al Fayette, and he and Jeff Sussman are doing an event called Drum is the Voice of the Trees tomorrow at the Armory for the Arts at 7:30 in the evening. It's their 14th show. They've been doing it since 1992. So check that out.
They've been doing this show since 1992?
Apparently.
Jeff Sussman, Al Fayette, Hidden Whale, Ink on Paper, Smokin' Bocce Tycho, all kinds of people.
Oh, okay.
In that event. That's it Candyman? Yeah.
I thought it said Armory.
Oh, no, you're right. It's at the Armory. Tickets are available at the Candyman.
All right.
That's right. That sounds like fun. Since 1992, how come I don't remember this event?
I don't know. But when I was in 1992, I was living in an apartment on top of the storage garage behind the diaper service, and he would practice in one of those open storage garages, and he was really getting better. It was cool.
Really? So you got to listen to him progress?
I listened to a lot of drum kit, yes, ladies and gentlemen.
That explains it.
Did you talk about El Maison Burt Dalton Trio with Miles Jaramillo and John Bartlett? That's Saturday, tomorrow from 7:30 to 10:30 at El Maison.
There's also a percussion clinic, I think, in sort of conjunction with this by Jeff Sussman, and that's at 3:30 p.m. In Benildis Hall, which is at the O'Shaughnessy Performance Space, the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. That is at 3:30 p.m. today, and you can call 984-1799 for more info. So you can move in, and then you can take a workshop, and then you can move in next to Mary Charlotte and bang your drums.
Yeah, there you go. Might not be as good in where I live now, but, you know, and when I lived on top of one of those do-it-yourself storage garages, and it was so great because you could make all the noise you wanted, and it wasn't a residential neighborhood. Anyway, just more, a little more Burt Dalton. Sunday at 3 o'clock, he and his trio will be at the First United Methodist Church in Albuquerque, and then Thursday of next week from 7 to 11, they'll be at Vanessi.
The Spirit of the Bee.
Yes, that's this weekend.
Beekeeper, educator Deborah Roberts and Laguna Santo Domingo Pueblo storyteller farmer Larry Littlebird are going to be talking, I assume, about bees. And that is 2 to 4:30 p.m. at the O'Keefe Theater at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture.
Yes.
On Sunday.
Yep. Good stuff. I had them on the radio. Lovely, beautiful people.
We did.
Talking about beekeeping from really more of a humanistic and spiritual point of view.
Neato. Hey, have you heard about this new business in town called Bistro?
You keep saying neato.
I know. It's my buzzword for the day.
Uh-huh.
You're going to hear it all
buzzing
over now.
Buzzing like bees?
Uh-huh. You're catching on. Have you heard about this new business in town?
No.
It's called Bistro, and I don't think they've like formally launched yet, but it's the store that's going to be downtown, and they're going to sell products that have a bee connection, and they also are going to make soups and sandwiches, and they will deliver in the Paseo Loop. And I think if you go to Bistro, BEESTRO.com, you can find out a little more information. But it's a really neat idea.
I have another event here, which isn't really speaking of the arts, but there's an informational meeting on Tuesday, October 25th, to introduce BEAR, B-E-A-R, an intensive outpatient treatment program for young people struggling with alcohol or drug addiction. And Dr. Lorraine Friedel and partners from the Santa Fe Mountain Center are going to be there. It's Tuesday from 11 to 2 at the Team Builders office. For more information, call 471-5006. You can go to teambuilderscounseling.org.
Can you believe that Buck is still going strong in theaters?
That's amazing.
That's
a beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful thing. There are lots and lots of films to be seen this weekend.
Besides the Santa Fe Film Festival and Santa Fe Independent Film Festival?
Well, I mean, you could just do that, but you could go see Laughing in the Darkness, which is a great documentary about, if I mispronounce the name, forgive me, Sholem Aleichem. Mm-hmm. And he is he created the characters made famous in the musical Fiddler on the Roof. And there's a documentary. And it got a sort of a favorable capsule review in Paso Tiempo, and that's playing at CCA Cinematheque. And at 4:30 p.m. on Sunday, October 23rd only.
Okay.
So.
And also Sunday, October 23rd at 1 o'clock in the Whole Foods Community Room, writers read, including Barbara Mayfield from her book, The Magical Mrs. Iptweet and Me. And, oh, God, there's so much more that we didn't get to. It always happens like that.
I know.
New Mexico Dogs, for example, October to New Mexico. Go to NewMexicoDogsDeserveBetter.org. There's another event tomorrow. But, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Rob DeWalt is with the Paso Tiempo Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he's with us every Friday, just about, speaking of the arts. And it's great to have you here.
I won't be here next week.
You
won't.
Did
you get my email? Oh, it's my birthday.
Happy birthday! I'm taking
a day off. I'm staying. I'm going to 10,000 Waves, and I'm going to stay in a hotel in Santa Fe.
How beautiful!
That's luxury.
Will we have the fabulous Robert Knott?
I'm going to poke at him today and see if he will come in and.
Can I poke at him?
Yes.
We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz. Hey, I upgraded my website a little bit, so you can go look at that, santafe.radiocafe.org. And we will see you next week. Have a wonderful day. Hasta la vista. Ciao.
Bye.